Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's nice weather where you are. It's hot here, but it's going to get better.
Yeah, I know. Before long, it will be winter, and we'll be freezing again, and dreaming of summer days.
That's true.
The thing about Iowa is, I think that we have one of the widest ranges of weather of anyone, of anywhere.
Oh, you know that saying, if you don't like the weather, just wait 10 minutes, it'll change.
Well, that's true. But I'm talking about our extreme temperatures. So we can get as high, rarely, but, you know, as high as 105, 110 with high humidity in the summer. And in the winter, again, rarely, it can be as much as 40 below with wind chill. So other places will get one of those extremes, but not usually both. So anyway, and actually weather has a lot to do with our book today, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And I think maybe those extremes are true and with the cold where our author was, which is the Colorado Mountains. So anyway, we'll find out about that. It's a very interesting book.
So would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, I would. It's Karen Avanen, and she is an award-winning poet, mountain woman, lifelong Westerner, and writer. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Real Simple, Light Hub, and numerous literary journals. She lives in the Colorado Mountains with artist Greg Marquez. Rough Beauty is her first book, and Rough Beauty is 40 seasons of mountain living, and it's really interesting. It really is.
And this is a memoir, right? Yes. So welcome to Writer's Voices, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Karen, what made you decide to write a memoir?
The first thing that happened was I had this very dramatic event, which was I moved to the mountains to be a writer, and 9 months later, my cabin burned to the ground. And so all my writer friends said, hey, that's a book. And, and I moved to another cabin, which is the cabin that's featured in the book. And, I worked on it, and I chipped away at it, and it never quite gelled. But then really when I started thinking about Rough Beauty, a memoir, because I was thinking about seasonal essays and fire as part of the season up here in the Rocky Mountains, when I started to think about a memoir, I actually started thinking about the question that I was most often asked when I was living at 8,500 feet alone in a wood stove heated cabin with my dog, and I did that for 10 years, why are you living up there, and why alone? And, this is a question that, frankly, no one asks a man. it was as if I was betraying my gender by doing something that, you know, really men should be doing or men are expected to do. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to answer that question by writing this memoir. And so the memoir is really about my deep relationship with landscape, which becomes a pretty deep relationship with myself and my strength and independence and, kind of feeling my agency in the world, which I think in retrospect I thought, you know, of course I didn't think about it while it was happening, but in retrospect I think that was great.
Well, what drew you to the Colorado Mountains? Because that's not where you were originally from, right?
Well, I don't really actually feel like I'm originally from anywhere. my dad was in the Air Force, and so we were kicked around by my dad's Air Force career. And we moved, not as often as some, but about every 5 years, which, kind of if you track it, there's a like kindergarten and then like third grade and then like, seventh grade. I mean, all really, tentative, worrying times in my life that we had to move. So we settled in Colorado in 1973. And then, when I was about, eight or something, and we left. And we finally circled back to Colorado. And the mountains have always felt like a place where I feel at home. Can you guys see the dog outside? I'm so sorry. There's a bear outside of our house right now. Anyway.
So is that a common occurrence, the bear in the
It has actually, interestingly enough, this summer has been a very common experience. We've got a mama bear with two cubs who wanders through.
Karen, when you decided to move into the mountains to be a writer, was the solitude part of what drew you there? Did you believe that that would help you in your writing?
Well, you know, the primary reason I think I moved to the mountains is that it was kind of this exodus away from, I didn't feel like I fit in my family. I was supposed to be somebody's wife. I was supposed to be, I got a lot of messages about how much I needed help or assistance or somebody to be by my side. And maybe I was supposed to be somebody's wife. And those things didn't jive with who I felt like I was. And so I kind of moved away from my family. And then I was getting those kind of same messages in, society too. When I was a freshman in college and I had difficulty in a freshman biology class, as, freshmen often do, I was told by my advisor, well, I was a pre-med student. They said, well, maybe you should switch to pre-nursing. And I thought, I just couldn't find a place that fit me. And turns out, the mountains were a place I felt comfortable. And so it turns out, so I moved to the mountains. And I had been living in the mountains, but closer to a mountain town prior to this move to the cabin to be a writer. And I really feel like the solitude and the space really fit my sensibility. So, yes, in the end, it was a move to kind of be a writer and be alone. But it was also a little bit at first I was completely running away from a society, from a family where I didn't feel like I belonged.
Now, you open the book, or at least fairly early in the book, you talk about the fire.
Yes.
But then you circle back a little bit before that. So I wasn't really clear where in this 10 years, this 40 seasons, the fire occurred.
Okay, so yeah, let me clarify that.
Okay.
So the opening chapter is the fire that happens when I first moved to the mountains. I have a cabin. I call it the Barkay cabin, and that's where I moved right after I finished my PhD, right before I turned 40, and I was going to be a writer. 9 months later, this cabin burns to the ground. All my writing, all my books, everything I've accumulated until that age goes up in smoke. The only thing that survives is my dog and myself and my truck. I was out delivering mail on a rural route. And so then in the book, I backtrack and talk about my childhood a little bit and kind of thinking about how did I get to the mountains and why did I become such a loner. And then I start with the beginning of the 10 years, which is that I moved to the place that I call the High Lake Cabin, and that's where I spent 10 years. And it was, and it's a different little cabin, and even more rustic than the first cabin that I lived in that burned to the ground. So the 10 years is in this place called the High Lake Cabin.
Okay. And now your dog, your dog's a pretty important character in this book.
He is. Elvis is was a blonde husky mix. And I got him because I thought, I wanted to do more and more remote things by myself. And I thought maybe I have a kind of terrific imagination, also a terrific fear of the dark. And so camping alone was sometimes a little bit fraught for me. I thought a dog will make me feel better. And he'll be my trail buddy. He was indeed a great trail buddy, but also, not necessarily the best very often what would happen is he would, I would awake to him growling very deeply, which is his, most menacing growl, like there's something big and bad out there. And I would sit up awake, and then the dog would eventually just go back to sleep, and I'd be awake for the rest of the night. So, he was really important. And I think, the most important thing is that, if you have a dog and it's a kind of one-on-one relationship, it's a very interesting, it's a very different relationship than, say, the family dog, right? And and he was really my, I say in the book, he was my guru and my guide in addition to my, kind of best friend. And I had built this very kind of hard exterior in my response to, this idea I kept thinking about. I felt like an alien. And so I, you know, Elvis kind of inserted himself between my breastplate and my skin, and he really taught me about unconditional love. I mean, what is it like to, you know, care for some another being? And this is something I didn't get in my, you know, my family. And so it was, he was great. And I think he kind of paved the way for other relationships in my life.
Now, I had a husky years ago that supposedly was like 1/4 wolf. I don't know if that was true, but
yeah.
And
oh, I think it was.
We lived, Salido, and we lived out in the country, and I would go for walks in the woods with her, and there were rumors about Bigfoot in the woods. There definitely were coyotes and things like that. No bears here in Iowa, but although people are seeing cougars. But anyway, That's another story. But when we would walk in the woods, I had to walk a ways to get to the woods. So we would leave the house together. We would return to the house together. But in between, I would just sort of just see her. She'd come flying by to check on me every now and then. But other than
classic.
That, she was roaming and just keeping an eye on me.
That's classic husky. I mean, that was the whole thing about my relationship with Elvis, is that I had to... I mean, he was out of sight in seconds, and I took him to dog obedience class, and which were kind of a bust because he couldn't believe we were going to be in a room full of dogs and not play with them. he was out, and he was a husky, so he didn't care about the treats. He was not trainable by treats or anything like that. And so they said, oh, well, just put a 30-foot lead on him and then step on it when he started to get out of range. And he was too fast. So part of our relationship was kind of learning to trust. I had to learn to trust that he would come back, or I couldn't ever train him to come. Like, he just wouldn't do that. But I could train him to wait, and he would stop dead in his tracks. And then I learned to anticipate. You know, it's really funny. I learned to anticipate, oh, he's going to chase that thing, so I'd make a loud sound to distract him. So it was a really interesting relationship and a really interesting way to learn how to kind of be with another being, I guess. But yes, I hardly ever saw him.
I really love huskies. I think they're probably my favorite breed of dog, and I've had a lot of dogs, and my grown kids have dogs. I'm very fond of them. I'm also very, very fond of my friend's pit bull, who passed away recently. I love dogs, but I think huskies are probably my favorite.
Yeah, we have another husky mix now, the one who's barking down the river. And he's so proud of himself when he alerts us that there's a bear out there. Like, hey, guess what? You know, so.
Yeah.
Usually the bear doesn't come through this late in the morning. It seems a little strange. Usually the bear's in the middle of the night.
Wow. One time, Salido, there was a coon came up in the yard, a great big coon, and she was. The dog was, Salido was outside, and I could, you know, it's the middle of the night, but I look out and I see her sort of facing off against this coon. Went to bed, I wasn't worried, got up in the morning, the coon was dead, Salido was fine.
Oh my gosh.
Well, Monica, when you lived in town, you used to walk with her, and she would just, if a dog approached, she would just stop and look at him and they'd take off.
Yeah, she had blue eyes, and that's can be a little intimidating. But also, she couldn't stand living in town. When I moved into town and I brought her in, she tore down my curtains trying to get out of the house. She almost chewed through a garage door, or clawed through a garage door. We had a 6-foot-tall fence. She would just go over it. And so it was when I had got divorced from my husband. So I let him take the dog back out in the country. He takes her out there, and she just went in the house and stayed there for 3 days. So it wasn't being in the house that bothered her. It was just being in the house and not being able to come and go as she pleased, like she could in the country. She was able, you know, she was never fenced, leashed, or anything when we lived out in the country. So
with Elvis, it was interesting because I, for a time, had to have him in the city when I was in Milwaukee doing my PhD. And, you know, so he had to be on a leash as soon as we went out the door. And it was miserable for him, and it was miserable for me. He didn't often get long walks that were leashless. And he became kind of he was an escape artist when I got him. You know, I was living in Jamestown, Mount Town in Colorado when I got him before we went to Milwaukee. And, he wiggled through an 8-inch hole in the fence. And, you know, you put him out in the backyard, and he was just figure out how to get out of it. Mm-hmm. But when I moved to the High Lake cabin, I was on an acre of land. There were a couple, you know, there were some about half a dozen houses nearby on acre or 2-acre lots. And what happened, I had a half-acre dog run. I put him in it once, and he barked, you know, for an hour solid, and that was it. I mean, that was the dog run. We never used it again. So I would just open the door, let him out in the morning. He would go outside. He would kind of do the tour. We lived in a cul-de-sac kind of off the main road, a dirt road. And he'd go check the neighbors' houses, and then he'd come back, and he would sit on the porch where he would sit for the rest of the day. And so I kind of realized that he needed a bunch of space around in order to stay put. And I also realized that I needed a bunch of space around in order to learn how to stay put, too. I mean, I had been kind of walking away from all of these things, as I've said. And once I got up there on the mountain, I really did just stay put. And that was, it was great for me.
Well, I think Salito and Elvis must have been related. My goodness.
No doubt.
You're definitely describing my dog.
Classic husky behavior. Yeah. Every husky owner knows.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Karen Ovenen, author of Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. Is it? I don't have it in front of me. 40. What's the subtitle?
40 Seasons of Mountain Living.
Okay, I got it right. All right. So, and the particular 10 years, the 40 seasons that you chose, is there a reason for that particular time frame that you chose to write
That's
about?
The time I lived in that little cabin, actually. Okay. It's really door to door. So I arrive at this cabin 4 months after my first cabin burns down. And it really takes the reader through these 10 years I spent really kind of recovering from this catastrophic loss, but also kind of rethinking my life. And seasonal living helped me do that. And at the end of the 40 seasons, I actually leave the mountain, Jamestown, the mountain town that I live nearby, about 4 miles down canyon, experienced a catastrophic flood. And at the end of the book, I have met somebody, first somebody in my life. I was never a dater, and we decide to move in together. And turns out there's no place to live in the mountains because a lot of property has gone down the river. It was a 1,000-year flood event in Jamestown, Colorado, and also along the Front Range. But Jamestown was the convergence of three rivers. It's a little teeny tiny mountain town of 300. There's a stop sign, a post office, and the Mercantile Cafe, and that is then houses, and that's it. And so it's a small town, and three rivers kind of came together. We had mudslides. We lost the former owner of the Mercantile, who's kind of a town patriarch and a figure in town, Joey. And so and a third of the homes in town were lost. And so it was pretty catastrophic. And even though I didn't live in the town, I lived about 4 miles up the mountain from them. It affected me. There were no rentals. There was no housing. So I actually moved for a few years down to the prairie with my partner. And then we just bought a house back in the mountains a year ago.
Wow. Are you glad to be back in the mountains?
I'm so glad. I can't even tell you. I mean, first of all, bear in my yard. And I've got fox at night. And there was a moose 2 nights ago. And so the wildlife, the space, the absence of streetlights. I really enjoy seeing the stars. Absence of, I don't hear my neighbors too much. When we lived in the prairie town, we were 2 blocks away from the train, which came through in the middle of the night, and our husky would sing to the train at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I just feel a little more calm when I'm when there's some space around me. So I really appreciate it. I appreciate the stability. And the other thing is, I honestly, you guys were talking about the weather. I cannot take heat. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get hot in Colorado, you know, even on the Front Range, like it gets hot where you are because we don't have humidity, but it gets hot enough. You know, and so anything really above 82 degrees is a little too uncomfortable for me. So I'm happy as a clam up here where the nights can be, even in the summertime, somewhere between 48 and 55 degrees.
Oh, wow. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the winters that you had to deal with in that Highline cabin.
So, you know, it was isolated, of course, and a little bit lonely, let us say. I mean, I would go days on end without speaking to anybody, and sometimes, you know, the sound of my own voice would startle me. But of course, the labor of winter is the labor of keeping the cabin warm. So every day I got up, and the first thing I did was build a fire in the wood stove. I never had fire overnight in the wood stove because of the house that burned down. It made me too nervous to have something going on in there. So I built a fire in the wood stove, and that cabin was really very rustic. And it was an old fishing cabin, and it was put up on pylons that are surrounded by brick, and a little bit of insulation under the floor, but the floors were just ice cold. And the wood of the cabin provided the insulation, but it was wood 2x4s. So everywhere those little wood bricks essentially came together, there was a tiny little crack. So sometimes you could see light. Sometimes in the wintertime, my first two winters, you know, my bed was facing a certain direction, and in January when, you know, it's like 10 degrees and wind is blowing and air is really crystalline, you know, it freezes, and it would blow through the cracks and onto my face. It's kind of fine, kind of sparkly little mist. It would wake me up. So I moved my bed, but put a rug up over that wall. So it was, you know, it was cold, and you know, if I had to leave, I had to, you know, a lot of wood in the stove and turn it down so that, you know, it would be reasonably warm when I got back. And of course, there was the work of getting in 4 cords of wood for the wintertime, and also, plowing my driveway, which was a little bit long. And I was very much just out of graduate school and not making any money. And so I didn't want to pay the plow guy. Even 20 or 40 bucks is a lot for me to come and plow my drive. So I had a 4Runner, and I would just go back and forth in my driveway, kind of plowing the snow myself, and that worked about 98% of the time. But you know, one of the things that happened is that I learned that, you know, nobody really does it alone, and the lie of the West is kind of independent cowboy on the horizon, off for an adventure. I really learned that really, we all need help, and we need community. And I relied on my neighbors to sometimes my so then my one neighbor, he started plowing me out during snowstorms, and you know, or if my car broke down, or if I needed a pair of snowshoes, you know, get out, you know, whatever. My neighbors really came to the rescue, so it was great.
Mm. I just can't imagine how you could even keep the cabin warm enough overnight to. That you don't freeze before you get
up
in the morning.
You know what? I love it cold. Mm-hmm. And there are, I have to tell you, there are mornings when I woke up and I could see my own breath inside the cabin. I had a winter weight down comforter, and sometimes when it was really cold, I slept with a sleeping bag on top of that. So, and I had a husky, and he was happy as a clam. So I sleep very well in that kind of temperature. It, you know, last night it was 67 degrees in our house, and I was dying when we went to bed. So
that was too hot for you?
Way too hot for me.
Oh, my.
You know, I'm between 50 and 55 degrees at night is how I like to sleep. So.
Wow.
So the cold doesn't really bother me at all.
Now, some of the, I remember reading the descriptions of, like, where the snow just was so deep, and you couldn't even see where the wood was.
Yeah, there's no, so my first couple of years, so I had my pine neatly stacked, because pine is really easy to stack, and I stacked it near my woodshed, so that, and it was covered with tarp, so that was great, 2 cords. And then I would order 2 quarts of oak, because oak burns hotter and cleaner. And it's better for the chimney pipe, and it's better for, you know, kind of keeping the cabin warm. And the oak comes, it's from railroad ties, and it's in wood blocks. And it's very difficult to stack because it's all uneven. And so I threw it on a tarp kind of off the driveway, and I covered it with a couple of tarps. And, you know, I thought, well, you know, you forget how much snow changes the landscape, particularly deep snow. So, that, you know, the first deep snow happens, there's 2 feet of snow, and I can barely see where my, you know, my wood pile, which is about 4 feet high. I'm like, okay, I think it's over there. Now I have to find the edges of it, and so I'm excavating the edge of the wood pile. Okay, so finally I do that. Then the winter wind kicks in. So at altitude, you know, if it's not snowing, it's blowing. That's what's happening. And the wind in wintertime is fierce. It was so loud that sometimes at night I would have to turn on a fan so I could sleep, because the wind was, it's a formidable thing. It's a, you know, force unto itself. And so the wind would come across the top of this wood pile, and it would drift over. And so then now I have to dig into the wood pile and try and find where it is. And, you know, that drifted snow is caked and thick and hard to get through. And so right here I am kind of trying to shovel upwards to get into this wood pile, and the snow is falling back down. You know, it's like, you know, shoveling upwards onto a mountain, and then the snow just keeps falling back down. So I learned a lot, actually, the first couple of years, and eventually installed a snow fence, which helped, so that the wind couldn't really do that much damage to my wood pile. But, it was a lot of work. I had these kind of crates that are about the size of a postal box, if you've ever seen those, and I would fill those, and I'd have to go in, and then I had a wood box on my porch, so I'd have to fill from the oak pile and from the pine pile and put them in the wood box, and then, so that was full, and then I had to haul stuff into the house to burn. So,
well,
but, why did I do it? I did it because I wanted to be self-sufficient. I wanted to kind of combat those messages that I was weak and I couldn't do it by myself. And, you know, in some ways I'm doing it for all of those people who've come up to me and said, I don't think I could ever do that. And I think, well, sure you could. Sure you could. But I liked feeling that I was, you know, in charge of my own survival. Mm-hmm. I really appreciated that. And that gave me a real sense of accomplishment.
Well, Karen, why don't you read a little bit from Rough Beauty?
I would love to. So I have three short passages. And the first passage really is about about where the title came from, but about my initial, these are all about my relationship with landscape, but this is about kind of how landscape, how much I kind of love it. The woods were the only constant in those years. I camped all over Colorado and in parts of Utah with friends and at times alone. Once settled on a wide bend in the Green River in Stillwater Canyon, Utah, I had watched the sun fall beneath a horizon formed by three distinct geologic formations, the passage of 1,000 years manifest in the shape of rocks. My own timeline was minuscule by comparison. The thought gave me comfort. To be a speck in a magnificent landscape, to be a part of ceaseless beauty. That night, as I contemplated the deep dome of glitter above, I thought about the Catholic heaven of my childhood, the place of eternal peace. I'd long ago given up the church, and as a little girl, I'd often cried in my bed at night as I tried to imagine forever in a cloud-filled elsewhere populated by ethereal ghosts. It no longer mattered that the world, there would be pearly gates or angels or even God. That kind of perfection had lost its sway. My preference was for the earth, with its rough beauty, its inscrutability, its mixture of shit and muck. I know what the world is made of, and I still love all of it, says Raina, the spirited ranch hand Gretel Ehrlich meets in the hollows of open spaces. As a slight breeze blew the heat from the day, I dug into the red dirt beneath me. I could spend eternity here. Overhead, a shooting star, one of the Perseids, ignited the sky, and I lay back, giving my body over to the earth's embrace. The second section is really, so this is, I'm living in, so the book is about seasonal living, and each chapter, I may skip kind of years, but it goes chronologically, but if we have a spring chapter, the next chapter is summer, and the next chapter after that is, fall and then winter. So this is a summer chapter, and just the first part of it. And I'm at the cabin now. Summer warmed suddenly, as it often did. One day was spring, with lilacs and forsythia popping out along the apron of mountains that led to the plains, and the next, the temperature blasted into the 80s. Up on Overland Mountain, after weeks of ululating highs, the days quite suddenly shifted to a perfect 78 degrees. Wildflowers exploding in the meadow behind the cabin and around the Peeper Pond. As people in Boulder sweltered in near 90-degree heat almost 3,000 feet down canyon, I stalked the meadows with Elvis in temperate air, collecting flowers for my notebook, the soft, fuzzy heads of pussy toes, which looked exactly like delicate cat paws, the lemony pod-like flowers of Golden Banner, or the faded purple of Lupin. Beneath each variety, flattened and taped to the page, I wrote its name and the date in an honest attempt to get to know my neighbors. When I'd first moved to the Bar K cabin, the cabin that burned down, staking my claim on landscape was the equivalent of stubbornly planting a flag and proclaiming territory. It was an act of conquest. I would seize the wild. I'd gotten exactly what I'd asked for. The unharnessed life I'd sought shoved its way into view the day my house burned to the ground. I didn't know then the strength of my own desire. I've never been someone who takes the easy road. Something in my body gravitates toward rocks and sharp edges, toward storms and umbrage. The summer I spent living in a tent in James Canyon after I'd changed my name, I decided what I needed was a few nights alone on the mountaintop contemplating my soul. I would fast and sleep out in the open. So I set off with a rain tarp and some water and climbed straight out of the gulch to the top of Castle Peak, pulling myself hand over foot up its steep face, trying not to look down or think of falling. It was August hot, and by the time I reached the summit, I had drunk most of my water. That evening, the thunderstorm rolled in. As I watched lightning flick and stab, moving closer and closer, I realized I was sitting on the highest point in any direction. Unwilling to give up, I lay flat on the ground and sang to the storm. The next day, out of water, I returned along a path I discovered on the backside of the mountain that meandered sweetly into a gulch. I'd softened a bit over the years. Now I wanted kinship, not conquest. At the highlight cabin, I wanted to become part of the pattern, the passage of seasons. So I wrote it all down, the first pass to the final purple aster that bookended the growing season, the weasel who lived beneath the house and turned snow white in winter, the chipmunk who led her pups to drink rainwater from a basin carved out of rock just east of the garden, the two pine siskins I drove to the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center after I found them sluggish beneath the bird feeder. Over time, I'd filled notebooks with what I saw, and in those details grew the story I shared with Overland Mountain. Don't write the poem about love, I often tell my students. Write the poem about making apple galette for your lover, or about your grandfather's hands as he ties flies. Let love rise out of the details. So I collected plants and weather, wildlife and birds, and in between the spaces of my notebook, love rose like a fish to the surface, like clouds of pine dust in the air. And I just have one more tiny little piece here, and this is actually the answer to loneliness, the question of aren't you feeling alone and lonely up there? This is after a dinner party. After everyone left, I washed the few dishes and glasses that were left. The wind had finally stopped, and the world was perfectly still. I could hear the deep whisper of Elvis's breathing from the bedroom. A waxing moon shimmered through the kitchen window, and aspens were silvery ghosts against the star-filled sky. An owl hooted across the snow-covered meadow. To some, it was a lonesome sound. In fact, aren't you lonely was the question most often asked of me after aren't you afraid. My answer was taped to my computer. Something Natalie Goldberg had been told by the Zen master Katagiri Roshi, anything you do deeply is very lonely. When I first read the words were an anthem, I would embrace the solitary life and not be afraid. I wanted them to remind me of what I'd chosen, that space and solitude was the right thing for me. There were indeed times when mountain living was lonely, but being lonely the way Roshi meant it, I'd come to realize, was not about isolation at all. Instead, it was about embrace. Lonely is a word that describes what it means to live profoundly. Moving deeply in the world, you let the thousand distractions fall away, and you become more authentic, more who you really are. Only on its surface was lonely a reckoning, the price of sinking in, but it was not terrible. And as a result of so much time, space, seasons, and land, I uncovered so much tenderness. It did not make me weak. Paradoxically, I touched more. Only when we have discovered the world for ourselves, writes Wendelberry, do we cease to be alone. I looked out the window. It was a beautiful landscape, a lovely, quiet night.
And you're listening to Writers' Voices, and that was Karen Avanen reading from Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living.
Boy, makes you think, gosh, you know, it would, if you could just transport yourself there, you know.
You want to go to Colorado, Mom?
Yeah.
Well, I hope the book transports readers, but I also hope that people are inspired to kind of undertake their own kind of forays into the wild. It doesn't have to mean I wasn't living, you know, kind of in a vast remote wilderness by any stretch of the imagination, but I did cultivate, you know, kind of a space where I could have some silence. And honestly, I think if any of us takes, you know, 2 days without our cell phone and, you know, goes somewhere and doesn't watch TV, I think, you know, time has a way of kind of spreading out before us. Without, like I say, when we let the thousand distractions fall away. And I also don't think you need to go to the mountains. You can go anywhere, really.
There's beauty in nature wherever you are.
Oh, yeah.
You can find it. Even in the middle of a city, you can find it.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So, Karen, how did you get from pre-med student to poet?
You know, writing really was my first love, and I was, as a teenager, of course, I wrote really bad poetry, like almost every teenager I know, and I really did want to be a writer. I fell in love with Truman Capote and Joseph Conrad and Shakespeare. And, you know, when I kind of popped up and said I want to be a writer, my dad said, yeah, but what are you going to do to make money? And so I think in response, I thought, you know, I'm going to pick the hardest thing I can think of. I guess that's in me. I'm going to show you. You don't believe me? I'm going to show you. So I picked biology and pre-med, and I would be a medical doctor. I was going to be a gynecologist, a woman's doctor. I wanted to deliver babies and hand out free birth control and stuff like that. Then I realized I took 5 years because I ended up double majoring in English, which was my real love, literature, of course. And I went to England for a semester and studied there in London, and I realized that I really didn't want to go to graduate school. So this happens my senior year, right? And I, about 8 weeks before graduation, I realized I didn't really want to go to medical school, and it was a big crisis. And I also realized that kind of medicine was kind of the smoke and mirrors. I'll show you. I'll pick the hardest thing, because I come from a blue collar family, and you know, none of my parents didn't go to college, and so I thought, well, I'm going to become a doctor, you know. And so that kind of failed. I started going back to school for literature and really realized it's now or never. And I took a poetry class with the poet Lorna D. Cervantes, and I showed her some of my poems, and I said, you know, this is what I really want to do for the rest of my life. And I was terrified, right? I was so terrified. And she said, I think you should, absolutely. And that was the first time I heard someone say yes to me. The rest is history, really. So I finished my degree in poetry, my master's degree, and then went on for a degree in fiction, which is a PhD. So I did become a doctor, just a different kind of doctor.
So what do you teach in the college? Where you, is it community college?
Teach at the University of Colorado Boulder. So actually, what's really funny is that, you know, when you're a writer, you get your PhD in, basically, I have a specialty in English literature, but my dissertation was a book of short stories, and so you become what they call a generalist. I'm not an academic. I'm just not an academic. I don't do those kind of big analytical papers, deconstructing King Lear and stuff like that, which I have done. So Actually, I've gravitated toward, I teach first years at the University of Colorado, and it's a population that I really appreciate and love. And I teach in what's called the residential academic program. So the students come in the dorm, they come to my classroom in the dorm. And so they ask me, and so when you're a writer, they say, can you teach this? And you say, yes, I can teach that. And so I actually started teaching film, and I've been teaching film for about 10 years. So film analysis, which is very close to literary analysis in some ways, except you're using visual forms instead of words on a page. And I love that. And that led to teaching, I teach a couple of film classes, and that led to actually a really deep interest in popular culture vis-a-vis through the lens of these kids that I'm interacting with. So I started teaching a pop culture class. Because they're, you know, in order to get them to think about the media that they're engaging in critically and how that media might be acting on them. And then I also teach a storytelling class. And the storytelling class is kind of a hybrid creative writing class, poetry, nonfiction, a little bit of fiction. But they also do kind of performance pieces, storytelling, performance poetry, and they do little tiny documentaries. So that's really fun, too.
Sounds like they get a good rounded education there.
Yeah.
Those are really interesting subjects, and it's interesting to me, you know, I'm a long ways past college and my kids are a long ways past college, so I don't really see what's happening in the academic environment. But some of the subjects of study now, it's like, who knew? I had a meeting last week with the University of Iowa Press to talk about having some of their authors on the show. And they do a whole series on a subject that is also, there's courses at the University of Iowa on fandom.
Oh, yes. You know, the study, popular culture studies is pretty big right now. And it's very interesting because, you know, I think probably you and I were brought up kind of on the classics and this kind of idea of there's high art and there's low art.
Mm-hmm.
And we studied the high art in college. And actually what's really refreshing is to study what has been categorized as low art. It's a recategorized, which is popular culture. And we're recategorizing it because, I mean, this is kind of it's an era when we don't need that division anymore. It's not really useful because this art is all around us and it's still interacting with us in really significant and important ways, and it's shaping our culture. And I think those studies are incredibly valid. I mean, I have my students, we start, of course, with kind of the beginnings of the pop culture, but we move into kind of contemporary era stuff. And every semester they bring in things for me to look at, and I think, I'm gonna teach this next semester, you know. So for example, one thing I've learned from them is that they all watch YouTube, and YouTube has an interesting algorithm that if you click whatever is, you know, suggested, and just keep clicking the next suggested thing, the algorithm is there to keep you in the system and watching videos. So the videos get a little more salacious and incendiary, and it leads you down a really interesting kind of, can be actually horrifying rabbit hole. And so after I learned about their kind of YouTube, my next semester I'm having an assignment where they're all going to kind of take the YouTube rabbit hole and see where it leads.
Oh, interesting. And they, you know, my six-year-old granddaughter has been doing YouTube videos, watching YouTube videos since she was 2 years old. She knows how to search for what she wants. She used to love the surprise egg videos. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but and also the ones of, there's this one little boy in particular that the kids all love, that he just like tries out toys and reviews toys. But recently she did these drawings for me, and you know, I was just like, how'd you learn to draw that? Oh, YouTube videos.
It's fascinating to me. And on the other hand, my brain is so trained a different way. I get really impatient.
Oh, me too.
Watching a series of 2 minute or 5 minute videos, I can't take it. Oh. I want to sink in and be there and not click, click, click.
Well, if I go to a website or a news site and a video starts playing, I click away immediately.
Right.
Particularly news. I don't want to I don't want to watch a video of somebody telling me the news because it's going to take 2 minutes for me to learn what I could read in 30 seconds.
Right.
And I just, you know, would rather read.
I think, you know, I mean, I think that this, so this culture of kind of clicking and watching and lots of information coming at us, and I have lots of statistics that I give to my kids about the, you know, the how much information they're actually, you know, getting every day and how many texts and how many whatever Snapchats and stuff. And it's a lot. And I think, but the other thing that goes hand in hand with that, I think, really is the high level anxiety among my 18 and 19-year-olds. And they all feel really anxious. And I think a lot of that is, you know, the stuff that is transmitted and also churned up through, you know, having an Instagram page where if you don't have, you know, 100 likes a day, then you must not be a popular person, or having a Facebook page for us, those of us who are older, and seeing everybody's perfect summer vacation on it, which, you know, makes me crazy, especially when I'm not on summer vacation, or, you know, the bouquet of flowers that they got at work or whatever. And so I think social media contributes to our anxiety levels. And my anecdote really is the natural world. You know, unplug and go sit on the ground for a little while, anywhere, in the park, out in the woods, out in the cornfield, I don't care where it is. Go, you know, just go and ground yourself for a little while, because I think that, you know, the news and all the messages that we're getting just kind of contribute to this low-level anxiety that all of us, I think, are feeling.
So, Karen, let's talk a little bit about your path to publication. So, when you started writing Rough Beauty, was it always your intention to publish? And at what point did you, you know, how long did you spend on the book? At what point did you find an agent or a publisher? Just talk a little bit about that process.
This is actually a great story. I mean, I turned about 28 and decided that I was really going to say out loud, I'm going to be a writer. And, you know, I was doing my master's in poetry. I had committed to the life of a writer, which means I was committing to not ever really making any money. And I was going to be a literary writer. So I, you know, published poetry and essays and short stories and got nominated for prizes and won prizes and stuff like that. But I hadn't had a book publication, and I didn't have an agent. And I had spent all of this time in this cabin. And for 10 years, I tried to write this book, Rough Beauty. And at first, it was going to be called Marlboro Woman. And it was going to be a collection of seasonal essays, and that was clearly going to be about my tough life. I mean, my tough self on the mountain, you know, me against the elements. And then for a little while, I had a publishing house interested, and they knew because I cook, and I have cooked professionally, and I cater, and I have legendary dinner parties. And the thing that weighs the most in my backpack when I go backpacking is the food I bring, because I don't take, you know, fruit and nuts and, you know, sea rations. I take good food. So,
no granola bars.
No granola bars. So anyway, so I had this publishing company that was interested, and they wanted me to write my tough mountain life. And then at the end of every chapter, they wanted me to have a, you know, some kind of recipe for something I made. And when I turned that in, they said, "Oh, we're not really. You're older than our demographic."
Oh.
So there was that. And then, you know, Elvis, you know, who was an extraordinary dog, he died, of course, as dogs do. And I thought, oh, I should write Loving Elvis. And so I kept trying to hit at this book. And what happened was kind of this godsend. My mother, who is in the book, for 10 years that coincide me kind of being on the mountain, she has a giant brain aneurysm that is 25 millimeters, and it's in the center of her head. And we had to take her to the number one brain surgeon in the nation to get it kind of fixed, which was coiling. Then it was a new procedure. And, you know, otherwise it was inoperable, essentially. And so she had about 4 to 6 good years, and then her last 4 years were pretty fraught, and she deteriorated. And I was her primary caregiver. And that was difficult because I was, I was the oldest daughter, and so she was a little tough on me. And so at the end, she was in a nursing facility in a bed. She didn't leave her bed for the last 2 years. She was on hospice for 2 years because she had simply given up. Her diagnosis was failure to thrive. And so I fought very hard for my mother to make sure that even in this kind of Medicaid facility that was not nice, that she got as much, the best kind of care that she could get. And at the end, I realized my mom was kind of, her brain was damaged from all the surgeries, and she was kind of moderately demented, and she didn't really care. She was perfectly happy to be there and eat her food and watch television. And so I just stopped fighting. And I said, at that time, I would go into the room and I'd say, hey, Mom, because my life had been pretty, you know, tough, tooth and nail, and I'm fighting for her. And I said, Mom, when you get to the other side, can you work a little magic for me? And I'd twirl my finger at her. And she'd twirl her finger back and say, okay, I'm on the atheist. She said, all right. So my mother died in January of 2015. And in April of 2015, out of the blue, I get an essay published in the New York Times. So I've been trying to get into Modern Love for about a million years, and they rejected me for like the 12th time. And I turned around and sent it to this, I think now defunct, blog that they had called Menagerie, which is about the life of animals. And it was, and the piece is called The Fox Who Came to Dinner, which is part of the epilogue of my book that was taken from that piece. And it was about this fox that I fed that wandered into my yard lame in January after Elvis had died. And so it became kind of my replacement dog and also a foil for this kind of blossoming relationship I have with this man, Greg Marquez. So this gets printed in the New York Times. I get 10,000 hits on my website. The next day, an agent contacts me and says, do you have representation? I burst into tears. This is the thing that you always want to hear. I'm now well into my 40s. And, I ended up signing with her. She's fantastic. It was a love match. I talked to a couple other agents, but it just wasn't good. And about 9 months, 8 months later, we sold this book to Scribner as a memoir. And then the real work began because the book I thought I was going to write is different than the book I did write. And so there's a kind of like fairy tale writer's story. This stuff never happens, but that's what happened, and it's been fantastic, and also really gratifying to have that kind of, you know, recognition, even if it came a little bit later in my writing career.
Wow! Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and the book was nominated for Colorado Book Award in Nonfiction, and so it's been getting great reviews, and I'm really pleased by that. And I have people who come up to me, you know, at readings, and also who contact me through my website and email me or Instagram or whatever, my social media, and then just say how much the book resonated with them or that it touched them, which is really the best thing a writer could ask for, that somebody sees themselves in your story.
Wow. And your website is KarenAuvinen.com, which is KarenAuvinen. And looks
right.
Like your blog is RufferBeauty.com.
Right, where I write about seasonal living.
Yeah, and that it looks like a really lovely blog with lots of great, great posts. It looks like you post an essay like at least once a month.
Yeah, I was before the book came out. I was posting twice a month, and right now it's very. I try to keep up to once a month. It's been book tour has been really busy this year, and both the physical book tour and the radio book tour. So. I've been doing nothing but running since June 5th when the paperback copy came out. It's that great new cover with the fox on it. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm.
So the book came out as a hardback first?
Yes, it came out as a hardback in June 4th of last year. That cover is different. It has kind of burnt paper that looked like the mountains. And I think I loved it. I thought it was so abstract and interestingly artistic. But now I have seen this fox, and I have fallen in love with it. I think, like that fox says, Rough Beauty. It looks exactly like what I think the book is about.
And how do they decide whether or not to release it in paperback after the hardback?
That was actually part of my contract.
Oh,
I had a
great.
Pretty major contract with Scribner. It was not a small contract. And so that was... I mean, I think that if my book had really tanked, I think they do have an option to decide to call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
But I have really great backing at Scribner. And, I mean, even, you know, Nan Graham is a champion of this book. She has been the legendary editor. My book is well-liked in the house. I mean, I think they really are cheering for it.
Oh. So what's next for you as a writer?
Next is I'm working on a proposal for another nonfiction book, which is called Flood Stories. So I mentioned the Jamestown, my community, from the book. So one of the things that happens in Rough Beauty is that I kind of flee to the mountains to be alone, and I realize that nobody does it alone, and that really I needed community. And by community, I mean, like, the most stunning moment for me of my life is my house burns down. I have nothing. I have no insurance. I have nothing. And the town of Jamestown, where I worked at the cafe, they throw me a benefit. And we're talking about people who I know don't like, some people who don't like me, a lot of people I don't like there in town, they all kind of come to this benefit, and they help get me back on my feet. And I realized that then that is real community is a relationship. Maybe it's dysfunctional sometimes, and maybe you don't really like each other, but you all – The relationship is more important than the individual, and when somebody needs help, you pitch in. And that was stunning to me to learn and to experience. And so I want to write about Jamestown now that's experienced this catastrophic flood. And I very much hear this town of 300 as a we, as a third person talking, kind of a little bit like a Rose for Emily, like by Faulkner. But what I'm doing is interviewing people who experienced this flood. Jamestown was divided in half for several days by the floodwaters, and people were stranded. And then when they were rescued 3 days later, it was the largest helicopter rescue since Hurricane Katrina along the Front Range when they were picking people out of the mountains. And so the stories are going to be people talking about their experiences of the flood, and I imagine that they're going to overlap and contradict. But I really hope that after people read it, they'll get a sense of what a community sounds like. And so I want to write about this flood and its impact on the community, and also, you know, the kind of environmental implications of this kind of 1,000-year flood event happening now when we're seeing more extreme weather events.
Well, Karen, we're just about out of time, but this reminded me of a question I wanted to ask you, which is, you write about real people in your memoir. Did you get any pushback on that?
You know, I didn't really get pushback. I expected it from a couple of arenas. I expected it from my family. My father was very gracious, I think, and I portray him not necessarily in the most positive light. He was, when I was growing up, a very violent man and temperamental and terrifying, honestly. But I tried to kind of also be generous with him in that my dad is also a really charismatic, fun person to be around and the life of the party kind of guy. So I also was really clear in writing the book, and I say this in my end note, that, you know, I know these people didn't ask to be written about, and this story is mine and isn't theirs, and they'd probably tell you something different, and I'm fine with that. So, but my dad was he didn't give me any pushback. He was, I think, very pleased that his daughter had done something and that he appeared in that work. And then the town of Jamestown, really, I haven't heard, they're still speaking to me, so I think that's all. I was actually talking to them yesterday I was floating the idea of the flood stories, and I think there'll be some grumbling about why does she get to write about it, but I think that, you know, because I was not in town at the, I lived above
right,
them
right.
at the time, but no one has been unkind to me, and in fact, when I released the book in hardback a year ago, the release party was at the Jamestown Merc, and there were about 100 people there.
Oh.
So that sounds
pretty good. That sounds pretty good. And we are out of time, but thank you so much for being with us today, Karen.
Thank you.
And, Mom, do you have closing words for us today?
I do. This is in memory of your dog, okay? When you found your dog Elvis at the Humane Society, it's what they say. You don't pick the dog picks you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye, everyone.